Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith and I'm joined today by Henry Jeffries, a wonderful writer who's written regularly for The Spectator and The Guardian, as well as The Critic, on various subjects, but often on alcohol. Henry is something of an expert on the subject, and he's the author of Empire of Booze and The Home Bar. Henry, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, very well. How are you?
Excellent. Now, many of us, indeed most of us, like to drink, but how did you get interested in the subject as a subject?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, there's sort of two things. One was I was at university in Leeds and there was an Odbins. I don't know if you know about Odbins, but they were these sort of kind of rather fun wine merchants that were set up in the, well, they had their heyday in the 80s and 90s. And I used to go and buy wine there at the Headingley shop. And they all looked like they were having so much fun that I thought that when I graduated, I did a degree in English. I didn't really know what to do with myself. So I thought, I'll go work in that shop where they're all having so much fun. So there's that. And I just sort of, but then I think I was probably interested before then. I had, my father was one of those people who kind of thought that wine was something that people should be interested in, even though he didn't really know very much about it. But it was kind of like one of the things you need to know about as a respectful member of the middle classes is wine. So I suppose it's two things. It's the family influence and also just having a shop that looked fun.
Excellent. And how did you get into writing about booze?
Yeah, well, that was interesting, actually. If you can kind of cast your mind back to 2005, I don't know how old you were, but there was a sort of heyday of blogging and people would, you know, set up blogs and they would write about stuff that they loved. And it was actually, in some ways, quite a magical time. And I was with some friends and they set up a blog about breakfasts called the London Review of Breakfasts. And it ended up being very, very successful. And they did a book, which I contributed to. And it was just this kind of wonderful outlet. And I wasn't a writer at the time. I worked in publishing. And I just found it kind of, I just loved it. I loved it. And I wrote under a pseudonym. We all wrote under pseudonyms. Pseudonym was Blake Pudding. And there was Malcolm Eggs, Dr. Sigmund Freud, you know, you get the idea. Armand Croissant, that sort of thing. And I just found it very liberating. And meanwhile, my head was filling up with all this wine knowledge that I'd accumulated, and I didn't really have any outlet for it. So I decided to set up my own wine blog, which was called, not very imaginatively, Henry's World of Booze. And I just started writing it. It was sort of that time people were very interested in blogs. So people would sort of like wine companies would be like, oh, you're a blogger, come to our event. And I was very lucky that I was, through my job in publishing, I used to do PR for books. One of the people I'd worked with was a writer called Craig Brown, who's a sort of satirist, humorist, you know, a very, very, very funny writer. And he read my blog and he sent it to Rachel Johnson, who at the time was editor of The Lady, sister of Boris Johnson, our, you know, former prime minister. And she called me into her office and said, would you like to be the Lady's wine critic? And at the time I had very little experience of writing. And also, to be honest, very little experience of wine. I just, you know, just used to write about what I liked. So I was sort of thrown in at the deep end with that. And I did that for about 5 years as the Lady's wine critic, which was quite funny because if you're the critic for the, if you write for the Lady, people treat you as if you're a character from a P.G. Woodhouse book. So you just go somewhere and go, I write for the Lady, and everyone just starts laughing. So, you know, it's a good icebreaker. And then it sort of continued from there. People, you know, it was, I hate to talk about this kind of heyday type thing, but there was, you know, people were interested in writing, you know, newspapers would go, oh, this person's quite entertaining, let's get him to write about drink. So it went from there. Then eventually it became a full-time job. About 2015, I gave up my job in publishing and became a full-time writer, which was, you know, I don't know, perhaps not a great idea at the time, but, you know, it's just about worked out.
Excellent. Happy to hear it. I think there's a, when people hear that someone writes about alcohol, there's probably a, an impression that that means they must drink a lot. But then when I think about people who write about food, when I think about A.A. Gill or Giles Corran, these are not people who strike me as gluttonous people. Do you have to drink a lot to write about drink? Or do you just have to be careful with, or maybe judicious with what you drink?
Yeah, well, you know, it is the worry. And I'm not saying that I don't drink too much, because I do drink too much. And there are people in the profession who are, they just use it as a cover for alcoholism. And it's, you know, it's a huge worry. And it's something that I have to be really careful with. I have to, so without trying to sound too sober and stuff, but I do have to be really careful that I don't end up drinking too much, because I do have basically limitless quantities of alcohol in the house. So you can go through stages where you'll just be like, oh, let's have a nightcap. Oh, should we try this? Should we try that? So I have to be quite, so it helps that I have a very sober wife. I think if I had a wife who is as keen on drinking as I am, then it would be a disaster. But I have a wife she's from California, and it's a very, very moderate drinker. So, you know, I don't want to get drunk on my own. So that really helps. But I have lots of sort of techniques, such as, you know, going home early. That always helps if you're out at some tasting or some sort of drink dinner. Go home early. If people are saying, when you're on a press trip to Scotland, let's go out boozing, don't go out boozing. You know, just that kind of stuff. Because there are people who, in the profession, who are alcoholics. And there are some who people I know who've drunk themselves to death. So it's, yeah, without trying to kind of sort of spoil the lighthearted tone of the podcast, it is something I have to be very careful about.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it's an inextricable factor from the profession, just as it is from the subject. And it's something that's very much linked to writing. Of course, the kind of stereotype of a writer is a hard-drinking, anxious, finger-bleeding sort of fellow. But also there is a kind of more refined aspect to the relationship between writing and alcohol. People who are great writers have written about alcohol. I can think of Kingsley Amis, who wrote, I think, 3 different books about drink. I can think of Roger Scruton, who I can't imagine was a very heavy drinker, but wrote very well about wine. Why do you think there's so much of a link between writing and drink?
Yeah, gosh, I don't really know. It's a tough one. I suppose, you know, you mentioned the, you know, the less aesthetic side of it. I think writers spend an awful lot of time on their own. They're often quite depressive sort of people. So there's that, but you're thinking more of the creative side of it. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it could be because it's just an interesting subject. It could be because it's sort of, I suppose there's also an awful lot of writers that don't drink, you know, or who aren't inspired. So, you know, I think you've picked some who are famously inspired by alcohol, but I suppose there's also, you know, thousands and thousands who aren't. So I'm not sure if there is a connection there. I didn't answer that one very well.
Yeah, but it's possible there isn't such an elegant answer to it. It might more reflect the kind of writers I like, because I like to drink. I gravitate towards writing.
Yeah, no, it could be. And there is that, those sort of wonderful, you know, sort of lunchtime writers, you know, Kingsley Amis, Keith Waterhouse, you know, Keith Waterhouse, who wrote splendidly about the kind of joys of lunch. No, I always imagine that Scruton would have been wonderful to have lunch with. I think he probably, if you got him going, would have drunk quite a lot, but very slowly, and then would have, I think about half of what he said would have gone over my head, maybe more, but I think he'd have been a great, did you ever meet him?
I never had the pleasure, sadly. I never had the pleasure, but I would have loved to. I think one thing he wouldn't have liked about me is, as much as I like alcohol, I have pretty much no taste. I mean, I'm the kind of person for whom wine comes in 2 varieties, red and white. And right. My favorite beer is the Polish lager, Tyskie, which All my Polish friends even think I'm terribly uncouth for enjoying. Do you think that kind of taste in alcohol is something that people have naturally, or is it something that can be acquired? So something where you can kind of learn to appreciate the different varieties of wines or whiskies.
Yeah, I think you can, but I think it has to be something that you're innately interested in. I think, you know, I think there's no point, pushing it. And also it is an expensive habit. If you're happy with your, you know, your Polish cooking lager, then, you know, you get to spend your money on other things. And it is a sort of really irritating hole to go down, because as soon as you start developing a taste for expensive beers and stuff, and actually, you know, I think of the stuff I used to drink as a student, I used to buy those 2-litre bottles of white cider, you know, the stuff that tramps drink. I used to buy that, you know, it was like £2 from a corner shop in Leeds. And I was quite happy to have that. And then we'd go out and drink, you know, Carlsberg or something. And I just, you know, I wouldn't do that anymore. And I'm not saying that drinking cheap white cider is good for you, because it probably isn't. But being able to just have a few drinks and enjoy very, very ordinary drinks is not a bad thing at all.
Yeah, I mean, drinking, I think, is always very much connected with the circumstances in which one does it. Like, I'm sure for most people, having a cheap bottle of wine with friends is probably better than having a very expensive bottle of wine alone. Although maybe that's...
Or even worse, having expensive wine with a bunch of wankers. You know, it's sort I get invited to lots of tastings, and often you're just surrounded by these kind of sharp-elbowed city boys, or you're with a load of pompous wine writers. You know, and I'm sure lots of people sit next to me and go, God, I don't want to sit next to him, he's so pompous. But, you know, I think writers, especially drink writers, food writers, can be a bit pompous. And everyone's there kind of going, blah, 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 you know. And you think, I would much rather be drinking a fairly ordinary bottle of wine with my wife in a cafe in Sicily than, you know, drinking Rijsborg with a load of drink writers, to be honest.
Yeah, I can more than understand it. I was going to ask, what are some of your ideal drinking circumstances?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, sort of any, really. But lunch, I mean, I really love having a long lunch. So just to sort of, it's, you know, I much prefer to go to bed early and then save my socializing for lunch. I really like having a kind of, like a strong drink, like a Negroni or something, and then share a bottle of wine with lunch and have a glass of port or something, then have a snooze. That's really how I like to drink. But then, I mean, there's so many great drinking circumstances. So a glass of cold sherry, 11 in the morning in the south of Spain. I mean, that's can't be that at all. Or sort of closer to home. I have two children, and sometimes on Sundays, I'll say, oh, I'm going to go to Tesco and get some parsley or something. And then I'll go and have a quiet pint on my own, just, you know, 15 minutes sitting on my own, staring into the distance, just have a pint of bitter. That's probably the most, or with my dad, doing that with my dad, sneaking off with my dad and having a couple of pints. That's sort of, you know, it's those kind of moments that you think the alcohol enhances the experience rather than being the experience.
Yeah, there's nothing quite as luxurious as stolen time, those special 15 minutes, 10 minutes and 30 minutes that we didn't maybe expect to have, or maybe others didn't expect us to have, but that we can just kind of prize out for ourselves. I know the feeling very much, very much. What are some of the drinks you've enjoyed? I don't want to use the word underrated. It feels kind of too modish maybe, but the drinks you've enjoyed that you think maybe other people wouldn't think of if they were choosing something for themselves or for a group of people.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good one. Well, there's a very famous but almost completely undrunk French brandy called Armagnac, which is the sort of country cousin of cognac. So it's made from similar grapes, aged in oak, and can be absolutely superb. And it's comparatively very, very cheap, especially if you compare it with Scotch whiskey. Scotch whiskey prices have gone absolutely insane, especially in the last year or so. Demand, and I think, you know, a bit of kind of price gouging as well. But Armagnac is very underrated. Nobody really, you know, lots of people do appreciate it, but there isn't that cult thing about it like there is with whiskey. So with whiskey, you get some brand, they release a 50-year-old whiskey for £10,000 or something, people buy it. In Armagnac, that 50-year-old thing will cost you about £100 or £150. So, you know, it's still expensive, but affordably expensive. So Armagnac's great. I love fruit brandies, you know, so they're very big in Poland, aren't they? So things like, you know, apricot brandies or cherry brandies, and some of them are, what's it called? Is it Sliwowice? Is that Polish or is that further east?
Sliwowice, yeah.
Anyway, very big in Eastern and Central Europe. Those are very nice. I mean, they can be very kind of badly distilled and give you a headache and stuff. But I had some very nice apricot brandy in Armenia, which was just absolutely wonderful. So yeah, unappreciated brandies are lovely. I'm really into port as well. I love, there's a thing called tawny port, which is aged in oak barrels, tawny, so it loses its colour and goes a sort of brown colour. That's, again, very underrated, very underpriced, and just nothing more delicious than a glass of tawny port after a meal. And again, not super expensive.
And I should say, Henry has just given me the opportunity to mention that he has a wonderful article about drinking port in the latest issue of The Critic, and about how to be able to drink port without having too many unpleasant consequences afterwards. Speaking of unpleasant...
Yeah, well, it's kind of...
No, go on.
You know, we were just talking about avoiding, you know, not drinking too much. And I think my constitution is not what it was. And if I drink a lot at Christmas, I get sort of acid indigestion, or even it's not just from drinking, it's from like fried food, garlic, spicy food. You know, I can't eat or drink like I used to. So yeah, I've written this slightly silly article about how to get through Christmas Day without having to reach for the Gaviscon.
It's a very entertaining article. I enjoyed and empathized with it. Maybe I'm going to take some of the lessons from it myself this Christmas. There's a kind of, I can't resist asking what I think is a slightly hack question, which you've probably been asked in every interview you've ever done. But what, in your opinion, is the most effective palliative for a hangover?
I've never been asked that. Never been asked that at all.
Oh, wow.
A swim in the sea, if you can, if there's a sea nearby and you can go for a swim, is absolutely incredible. You can, I've felt like the world is going to end and you go in the sea, and I don't know what it is, whether it's like the sort of cold, warm sort of thing, that is incredible. Or, you know, a swimming pool, shower, you know, if you can't, but a cold shower really helps. Apart from that, there's no real answer, really, because it's just, you know, you've done it to yourself. I find things like people love heavy fried food, and I find that just makes me feel worse. Go for a walk, you know, lots of fresh air, walk. Get out, you know, don't stay in bed. You know, I suppose Kingsley Amis talks about the psychological hangover, doesn't he? Which is almost worse than the physical one. So the thing to do is don't stew, don't sit, don't just stay in bed, don't just watch telly, go for a walk, go out and talk to people. Maybe go and phone people, but that might be a good idea, because you've always got that kind of, you know, that looming dread that you've said something that you shouldn't have. Go and talk, get some human interaction to realize that you're not too completely unlikable. I think you're probably giving away a bit too much there.
I have wondered before, because I have the same terrible consequences, and I've wondered before if there was some kind of perfect cure for all the symptoms of a hangover that they did manage to develop pharmaceutically, would it be responsible to release it?
Or funny enough, I was thinking just this to myself, because I drank too much on Friday night, and I was thinking, this would be so dangerous if I didn't feel like this, because it would be like the kind of the nuclear bomb of alcohol research, wouldn't it? It would be like, once that was out, you couldn't put it back in the box. It would be, you know, Prometheus, Pandora's box, all these. What's that quote from Jurassic Park? You know, they were so busy seeing if they could do it, they didn't ask whether they should do it or something like that. Yeah.
I definitely would have drunk far more than I have done and far more than I should if I didn't have those terrible mornings of the soul. So in a way, I guess they're good for me, because they're not going to restore your health entirely. Have you heard about these IV treatments they have in the USA, these very expensive kind of labs for lawyers and finance guys, where they get hooked up to some kind of drip and it sends all of these fluids and nutrients through their bodies, and it's meant to, you know, restore their constitution for the early morning meeting?
No, really? Gosh, I didn't know. That sounds very Patrick Bateman, doesn't it? From American Psycho. You can imagine him kind of, you know, a night on the blow, murder a few people, and then hooked up to the IV, and you're ready for your meeting with Credit Suisse.
Yeah, I think they're meant to be fantastically expensive, so it probably is Patrick Bateman's going in there. Of course.
Can I ask you a question?
Go for it.
Is Poland has something of a reputation for being a place where people drink a lot. Is there a very different drinking culture to England, or a heavier drinking culture? Do people just drink more?
I suspect there's not. I think we possibly have a bigger problem with having major alcoholics. I think part of that is possibly because it might be changing now, but we haven't really had many other drugs apart from alcohol, because alcohol was so deeply rooted in communist life. So we possibly have more problem drinkers, but overall, I'm not sure we do. I think we still have more of a pub culture because alcohol is cheaper here, and because, I don't know, there's something more social about Polish pubs, at least in my experience. There are a lot of people crowded around the bar often. I think nearly everybody I know in Poland, I've met at the pub. My best friend was a barman. That's how I met him. My other half I met in a bar, so there is maybe more of a social aspect to it, but it's not quite as awash in vodka as the kind of stereotype suggests. And actually, interestingly, now Polish drinking culture is becoming a lot more refined than it was. So when I came here, if I was going out on a night out, I knew that meant a lot of vodka, but now it could mean wine, it could mean whiskey, it could mean, sadly for me, gin. There's a lot more kind of sophistication going on with drinking.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Obviously, like you say, I mean, every country has its own drinking culture. Every country has its own drinks. The kind of field of alcohol, you've never reached the end of what you could experience. Are there any kind of drinks that you're still waiting to experience? Like, you haven't had the chance to enjoy them yet, or at least to enjoy them fully?
Yeah, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, there are all those sort of drinks that don't sound very nice, you know, like the ones that they drink in Mongolia, which is made from sort of rancid horse's milk. And then they just kind of put it in like a leather pouch and just leave it to ferment. And it makes this sort of cross between kind of beer and cheese, which I think is what Genghis Khan used to drink. And I just think that that's really, really never appealed. And then I suppose there's wine from countries that I don't really know about, which I'm quite interested in. So Georgia makes some very interesting wines, but I have almost no experience of drinking Georgian wine, so I'd be very, very curious to try that. But apart from that, I mean, and then China has its own very peculiar drinking culture and drinks. They have a thing called Baijiu, which they keep trying to, the drinks industry keeps on trying to foist it on Western Europe. And it still, you know, it tastes quite distinctive and a bit weird. And so it's one of those things that might take a bit of time before it takes off. But I don't have very much experience. I've tried it a few times and thought, that's not as unpleasant as people said it would be, but I have no reason to ever want to drink that ever again. But then if I was on a, you know, if I was in China, then, you know, obviously, when in Rome, when in China.
I still can't quite get
it. It's funny, actually, it's more the drinks that I actually have no interest in at all. Like, I got sent a book on sake, you know, the Japanese rice. People call it rice wine, but it's closer to beer. And there's a whole culture about it and, you know, a whole sort of sophistication around it. I just don't have any interest in getting into it, which probably makes me seem very parochial, but I feel like there's so many great drinks over here in Europe and the sort of European diaspora that I just want to get to know the drinks that I already know better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's only so much we can drink. We don't want to waste it on the stuff that we don't enjoy. I can't quite get over the thought of this Mongolian horse milk drink. I think if I'd been Genghis Khan, it kind of explains to me why he wanted to kill and butcher and pillage so much, if that was his idea of a good drink. I can see why he was in a bad mood. But
yeah, presumably exactly. Powerful, but it's very much, you know, it's a nomad's drink, isn't it?
It would put me in the mood for killing as well, I think, if I had to drink that too much. It's a kind of a scary question, I'm sure, for somebody who enjoys the whole field of alcohols. But if, for some bizarre reason, you could only drink one drink for the rest of your life, one alcoholic drink, of course, and you could have it in unlimited quantities, but you had to choose one, what would you choose?
Well, I mean, it might seem odd because wine is my speciality and I've written more about wine than anything else. But I'd probably choose beer, not because I don't really know particularly much about beer and I very rarely write about beer, but there is something uniquely satisfying, I think, about beer. And I think especially, again, this is going to sound a little bit parochial, but English beer, the sort of traditional lowish alcohol, best bitter stuff, I don't know, I think it's perhaps because it kind of, I feel a connection between that and my father, who was used to, I mean, he's still around, but you know, there is a sort of emotional thing there. It's also what I miss when I'm abroad. Again, this is going to sound very parochial, but if I'm abroad for, I love to come back to England and go to a sort of old-fashioned pub and have a pint. It would be if I could only choose one drink for the rest of my life, it would be a really nice kind of 4% English bitter, like Harvey's Best or Timothy Taylor's Landlord or something. But I don't know, in this scenario, am I allowed to have other beers or is it just one beer? Can I have?
Yeah, you can have Polish beers. You can have other. You can have any kind of beer.
I think it would probably be the beer then, because beer is just incredible and you can get, you know, Belgian beers and Polish beers and, you know, American beers, and it's just, and then the kind of uniquely satisfying English beer. So yeah, go for beer.
Speaking of English beer, I mean, right now it's a pretty dark time, I'm sure, for English pubs. It's a dark time for Polish pubs, and I don't think we have quite the problems with, quite the problems with energy prices. We certainly have problems with energy prices. And also taxes in Britain are much higher. I suspect people are still more concerned about COVID. How much damage do you think is going to be done to the pub industry, if I can call it an industry, in the next few years?
Oh, yeah, it's really worrying. It's really worrying. COVID was just a complete shit show and it just destroyed them. So many of them. There's so many. I live in rural Kent and you just drive past. Oh, that was, I only moved out here in 2019. You just go, oh, that was open. And it was just, you know, a lot of people just were like, you know what, we weren't making a lot of money before. This isn't worth it. It was, you know, it was an absolute tragedy. And I think people will look back and just think we kind of lost our minds for a bit. And what's funny is, you know, it's sort of over. You know, there are still cases, but people just, I remember I read an article somewhere and they basically said that COVID will be over when people are bored of it. and that's what happened. You know, people just were like, you know what, I'm just going to take this risk. But no, it's really worrying, the pubs and then the fuel bills. Because I was thinking, you know, energy crisis, I'll just move into the pub. But then if the pub can't afford to heat itself, can't afford to cook food. And then the kitchens of the pubs were ruined by COVID and by Brexit. So that they, you know, loads of staff went home. I think it was probably COVID hit them worse. So, you know, a lot of places, they still haven't got their food in order. And then the taxes and stuff. And lots of breweries are going out of business. There was a very innovative brewery near Bristol called Wild Beer, which won BBC producer, BBC Food and Farming Producer of the Year. They've just gone out of business. And there's loads of them. They're all going out of business. It's a very worrying time. And not just for beer producers. I think it's a very worrying time for all small businesses. I think the combination of sort of energy crisis, COVID, taxes, it just screwed them. You know, I think it's really, really sad. And I wonder, you know, because, you know, there is the sort of cycle of businesses forming and going out of business. But I just think nowadays it's probably who would take the risk of starting up their own brewery or
pub. Yeah, I thought of that as well. I've always had this small fantasy about opening my own pub. Like if I just happen to fall in a hole and find £1 million. But it must take a lot of guts to do in the contemporary climate, because the odds are heavily against success all the time for a small business, but especially today. But let's end on a more positive question. I'm sure you've had innumerable very happy drinks over your life, so I'm sure you can't think of the happiest. But what would you say was one of the happiest drinking experiences of your life?
Ooh, well, my wife and I had this wonderful, my wife and I actually met in Sicily, and she's from California. There's a long story, but I won't go into it. And we had a holiday, our first holiday without our eldest child. My parents looked after her when she was about 2 or 3. We went to Sicily, and it was partly to research Empire of Booze, but mainly just have a holiday. And there's a really lovely Sicilian red wine called Frappato, which is a very light red wine that's like a bit like a Beaujolais. And we went to some restaurant in, I think it was San Vito Lo Capo, the far west, and it was just beautiful food, lovely weather, chilled bottle of Frappato with my wife, and just feeling very kind of young and carefree and happy. You know, not a remarkable wine, but I can still remember, you know, how it tasted, how it went with the food. And that was a very special moment.
Not a remarkable wine, but a remarkable situation in which to enjoy the wine. Absolutely. I've had many of the same experiences, largely involving Tiskia, but the company and location making it more special. Henry Jeffries, thank you for joining me today. Just to say again, Henry is the author of Empire of Booze and The Home Bar. Very much.
I've got a new book coming out.
He has a new book
Vines coming out. Vines in a Cold Climate, which is about English wine. They make wine in England.
Excellent. When is it coming out?
It's coming out in August.
Should
I say that again?
So I was going to say, when is it coming out? But you've just answered my question. Excellent. So that's something to look out for in the future. If you like drink, if you like wine, or if you just like good writing. Henry, thank you very much.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.